You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey y'all, Karen here. This is a friendly disclaimer that due to a mic issue, you might hear some static in the second half of this episode. We tried to minimize it the best we can, and special thanks to friends Leland and Winter for helping out. So, with that said, let the show begin! Gallivanting, galloping, gadgeteers, gabbing in gantries. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 202, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your very vocal volcanoes vomiting volumes of vocabulary.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
I actually want to start the show with something we haven't done in a while.
Oh my
this
goodness.
Is inspired
we haven't
by...
done a lot of things in a while, Karen.
Yeah, that's true. We had a kind of like a public Q&A on our fan group, our Lobetrotters, Good Job Brain, Lobetrotters fan group.
Yeah.
And listener Stephen Shepard said the following. I love the segments where you try weird foods for the first time.
Oh, no.
Any plans to have more of this? Still can't believe you guys ate that gum.
I remember that gum. Sometimes before I put a gum in my mouth, I'm like, is it going to be that gum again? I hope not.
So astute longtime listeners know, pretty much early on in Good Job Brain history, we had a 1980s trivia card pack.
Yeah.
Early 80s, like trading card packs.
Yeah.
And we opened it for fun and answered some questions. Little did we know that it came with gum.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was fun to a point.
Yeah. They didn't try it like toddlers or something.
Yeah, we're like, well, we have to eat it. Oh. And I did not. You three actually ate the gum.
We did eat the gum.
Yeah.
It dissolved.
It was like a mixture of paste and one of those rubber pencil erasers.
Yeah. Really?
All of the things that made it gummy had...
chemical
had
paste.
Fallen apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, collapsed. Yeah.
All the binders.
Yeah.
And in the spirit of more listener stuff, so here I have a gift from Carmen and David from Pataskala, Ohio.
Oh,
okay. I took out the wrapper, so no one knows what it is, and I have a special treat.
I almost just ate that before our show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, you put it right next to the snacks.
So here I have these little, they look like... acorns. They look like pale little nuggets.
Okay, let me see. Yeah, I agree. That looks like a pale little nugget.
And here, I think we should start the show by trying this.
Will you tell us anything about this?
It is candy.
Okay. So it's not a naturally occurring like seed pod or something.
Is this slow carb? Can I eat this?
It's sugar.
It's sugar.
But you can lick it.
Okay.
All right.
Or spit it out.
Okay, here we go.
All right, I'm going to take my mouth away from the microphone for the sake of our listeners,
okay.
And then I'm going to put it
I'm
in.
Give me get
the
closer to the
so
microphone.
I can spit.
Okay.
Spitball.
Okay.
So sweet.
Mm.
Kind of
banana-y.
Yeah, a little vanilla-y, a little almondy.
I don't know. I think there might be stuffing in the middle. I don't know.
I see little black dots before I put it in my mouth. Mm.
Well,
I don't know if that's...
so far, so good.
It has kind of a musky taste. It tastes like onions to me.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah. A little bit like onion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A little
like
sweet onion.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now that you say it, yeah.
Yeah, it mm-hmm. does. Oh, yeah, I'm getting a big hit of onion now.
what a strange reaction. I know what it is, obviously.
Oh.
Okay. Don't spoil it.
I think I got it.
Okay. Do you guys have a... There's a spitball if you guys want to spit it back out.
Hmm. I'm committed at this point.
Woo!
I'm going to try it one more time.
It's a strange mix of sweet and savory.
Oh, like when you bite it, it's real musky. It tastes like an animal's excretion, like musk.
Yeah, I think I have a sensation of what
my best guess is. Yeah.
Oh, I smell it now. Oh,
yeah.
God. It is. Oh, wow. This smells like the real thing, too. Ooh, it is. Chris, what's your guess?
My guess was garlic.
Oh, it's not. Yeah, you know what? It's not onion. It's like garlicky now.
Yeah,
Dana?
Onion or garlic, something.
Mm.
Colin's gonna spit it.
Yeah,
out.
Now it's more garlicky.
My guess was sweet onion.
It is durian.
Oh, you know what?
Oh,
durian candy.
I was gonna say that just for the hell of it, but I've never actually tasted durian.
Right.
It smells like it.
I've smelled it.
This smells like it. It's sulfury. I think it's where you guys get the garlic and the onion
from.
Yeah,
the pungent.
Yeah.
That's not.
Oh, okay.
It's not. It's not a terrible candy.
Yeah, this smell.
I've had worse candy.
Dana. We've had worse candy. Thanks, Dana.
You don't like extremely salty black.
So durian is a Southeast Asian fruit, and it is, you know what? It's one of those things that people make fun of because it smells really bad. It's very sulfuric, kind of rotty taste, musky, I guess. The texture of it, the real texture of the fruit actually is kind of like ice cream. It's very smooth and very creamy.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
It has like a vanilla banana taste, but then you have to deal with the scent of the onion.
It's outright banned in a lot of places. I remember
recently
traveling,
it was in the news. They had to
evacuate a library.
Because they thought it was like some chemical.
It was
agent.
Rotting durian. Right?
Yeah, it wasn't just a durian. It was a rotting durian, right?
Well, there you go, Stephen. We just tried something new, and thanks to our listeners from Ohio who sent us those nuggets.
Thanks, guys.
Ohio, of course, known
for their durian
high
production.
Quality. The durian heartland. Well, I've got a extremely good job brain story that I had to at least bring up on the show. You guys probably saw it. It was all over Facebook a few weeks ago. It was just all over the internet. I think it got picked up by every major news story. If I say the words seagull and pepperoni, are you guys familiar with this story?
No, I am actually not. I missed it.
Oh, all right. I'm glad at least one of you guys did not hear the story. So hopefully that means somewhere one of our listeners, or maybe you're listening to this show 7 years from now and you will hear the story for the first time. This is fantastic. This is truly a good job brain story. So this happened in Canada. So I figured I'm going to quote liberally here from a CBC article about the story. The headline is, "How Seagull's Pepperoni Got Dartmouth Man Banned from Posh BC Hotel." That's British Columbia. So the Fairmont Empress Hotel in Victoria had a 17-year-long ban against a man named Nick Burchill. And he posted on Facebook his lengthy, hilarious, true story that he wrote a letter to the hotel basically asking for the ban to be lifted. He's like, "I think I've done my time. Can you please let me back in?
So I
can stay at the hotel again." Here again, quoting from the CBC article. "The Fairmont Empress has lifted its ban against Nick Burchill 17 years after dozens of seagulls trashed the man's hotel room while feasting on enough pepperoni to fill his suitcase."
What?
So this is from his letter on Facebook. "I told my Navy buddies I was coming out west, and I was asked to bring Brothers brand pepperoni from Halifax. It is a local delicacy. Because this was the Navy we were talking about, I brought enough for a ship. So in a hurry, I had completely filled a suitcase with pepperoni for my friends. Some of it was wrapped in plastic, some in brown paper. I took whatever Brothers would sell me. This is the bag that my airline misplaced." So he showed up at the hotel. The bag showed up the next day. Now, he knew the pepperoni would be good. I mean, it's a cured meat, right?
Yeah.
But he wanted to make sure that it was like at least kind of, you know, a little more presentable. So just to be safe, I decided I should keep it cool. My room was a nice big front-facing room on the fourth floor.
No.
It was well-appointed but did not have a refrigerator. It was April. The air was chilly. An easy way to keep all of the food cool would be to keep it next to an open window. So he opened a window, laid the pepperoni out, thinking, you know, like a pie, it's going to cool off, you know?
On the sill.
Yeah, just on the sill, like you do when you got your pepperoni. Then I went for a walk for about 4 or 5 hours.
Wow, that's a long walk.
Like a touristy.
You got to stretch your legs. When I covered enough ground, I returned to the hotel. I remember walking down the hallway, opened the door to my room to find an entire flock of seagulls in my room. I didn't have time to count, but there must have been 40 of them.
Oh my God.
And they had been in my room eating pepperoni for a long time. In case you were wondering, Brothers TNT pepperoni does nasty things to a seagull's digestive system. At this point in the story, like, this is when it becomes like a Mr. Bean episode to me. You know what I mean? Like, I just picture him. Yeah. As you would expect, the room was covered in seagull crap. What I did not realize until then was also that seagulls drool, especially when they eat pepperoni. So, I mean, these poor birds, these poor birds,
they,
you know.
They don't know what they got themselves.
They thought they hit the jackpot. Yeah, exactly. So, I'm sure you have an image in your head, going back to Nick's letter here. Now remember that I have just walked into the room and startled all of these birds. They immediately start flying around and crashing into things as they're desperately trying to leave the room through the small opening that they had entered.
So basically, he tars and feathers the room.
Yeah, exactly.
Like with seagull poop and spit, and then they smash all into it.
And he scares the... I mean, he literally scares the crap out of them when he comes
in. You gotta figure at least 50 to 60% of those seagulls immediately poop themselves at when he walked in the room.
Less composed seagulls are attempting to leave through the other closed windows. I think the money quote of Nick's letter. The result was a tornado of seagull excrement, feathers, pepperoni chunks, and fairly large birds whipping around the room. So he opened the other windows to the room. Like, you know, smart.
He went through.
That's exactly what his letter said. I waded through the birds. Swim move through the birds. Opened the remaining windows. Most of the seagulls left immediately, fantastically. One tried to re-enter the room to grab another piece of pepperoni. And in my agitated state, I took off one of my shoes and threw it at him. Both the gull and the shoe went out the window. Now, but he had gotten it down to one seagull left, but he was, like, chasing it around. It was, you know, didn't want to leave, has a big piece of pepperoni in its mouth. So he grabs a bath towel and basically tackles the seagull. He wraps it in the towel.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he pitches it out the window.
With the towel.
With the towel around it. As he says, I'd forgotten that seagulls cannot fly when they are wrapped in a towel. He said the bird is okay. He said the bird was a little dazed, but was okay. Mm. But of course, he's now thrown a shoe, a towel, and a bird out
of his
window. Right. So people out in front, of course, are watching this, like, what the hell
like
is happening?
Coming out of a room.
Yeah. So let's reiterate here that Nick is in town on a business trip, okay? So he's got to get ready to go to an event at this point, okay?
No.
I was new to my company. I was really hoping to make a good impression. I decided I would carry on for now and just deal with this whole thing later. So he only had one shoe. So he went downstairs, got the other shoe, got the towel, came back up. He washed off his shoe, and I like his thinking here. He says, in retrospect, I should have just wet my other dry shoe instead of trying to dry the wet shoe. Mm-hmm. So he plugs in the little hair dryer in the room, drying the shoe, and then the phone rings. So he goes to the other room, and then all of a sudden the power goes off. So it turns out that the hairdryer had wiggled free of the shoe and fell into the sink and blew out the power for the room, possibly some for the whole hotel. So at this point, somebody from the hotel comes up, right? And he says, I can still remember the look on the lady's face when she opened the door. I had absolutely no idea what to tell her, so I just said, I'm sorry. And I went to dinner. When I came back, my things had been moved to a much smaller room. His company received a letter that he had been banned from the hotel. So this was 18 years ago, almost, you know, when a younger, more naive Nick was doing foolish things with pepperoni. So he decided he was back in town. He wrote the hotel a letter to see if they would, you know, either rescind the ban or consider it time served. And he also gave them a big sack of pepperoni. Yes. They did lift the ban. They considered his 17-year ban, you know, enough.
It's not his fault.
Well, it's, you know,
kind of
maybe not directly his fault. Yeah. So
seagulls are hungry and aggressive.
He left the window open and a bunch of bait out.
He was baiting the birds.
Yeah,
I mean,
that was foolish. But
hopefully they have refrigerators in the rooms now so he can keep his pepperoni.
How he kind of blamed the hotel. It's like, it didn't have a refrigerator.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. So this was just one of those stories.
What can we learn from this?
Oh my goodness. Nothing.
There is no lesson.
Just laughs.
Yeah.
The Oakland Coliseum, where the A's play, it's funny because it's inland compared to, say, the Giants Stadium, which is right by the water. Mm-hmm. But somehow the seagulls flock to the Oakland Coliseum, and they're everywhere.
They
just know. They just know. And they're like, all over in people's hair.
They're not
stuff.
Scared. They're not afraid.
They're not scared at all. And so the Coliseum facility was like, we got to address this problem. Oh, we got a great idea. And so they have these kites that are like big falcons.
Oh,
so they look like real falcons. Ooh. And then so they attached two of them to try to scare off the seagulls. And they had a naming competition. It's an internet like naming competition. And of course, the internet decided.
Hockey McHawk face.
Falcon McFalcon face. Very good. And they're like, oh, this is gonna be it. Nope. Seagulls not scared.
Oh, really?
The fake falcon kites that just like kind of fly in one area. Like the seagulls are just.
I like how they had a naming competition, and then it's like, oh, it doesn't work.
All right. Well, thank you, Colin, for that wonderful story. Riveting.
I couldn't resist.
Without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, pop quiz, hot shot. And I got a surprise in my random Trivial Pursuit card box draw. We usually have a random card. We keep having kind of the same editions, and I kind of really dug down in the corners.
Yeah.
And I got a Trivial Pursuit Totally 80s card.
Nice.
Something we haven't done.
I'm excited. I'm legitimately excited.
One of us was a little more conscious in the 80s.
That's a very kind way of calling it old. I like it.
Buzzers at the ready. Here we go. Blue Wedge for TV. What TV show told the tale of a commando unit that was sent to prison by a military court for a crime they didn't commit? Everybody.
The A-Team. Da-da-da.
Next question. Pink Wedge for WC. World events, maybe? What 96-mile-long structure came crashing down in 1989, scattering large chunks all over the world? Oh. Everybody.
The Berlin Wall.
Wow.
The Berlin Wall.
We're all trying to match each other's face.
Berlin Wall. All right, next wedge, yellow. Who did Ronald Reagan ask to lead the team that greeted Iran's former hostages in West Germany?
Oh. That's a good question.
Colin.
Nancy Reagan.
Oh, no.
I don't know.
Mr. That's not bad. Chris.
Emmanuel Lewis, TV's Webster.
He was beloved.
Yeah, he was. Who would you want to see when you're coming home to America?
Yeah.
You just want to see Webster.
I think Mr. T.
Yeah.
And then you feel like protected.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
No.
What is it?
It is Jimmy Carter.
Okay. All right. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Because it was right
out of sense.
Have we thought about it hard?
Next one, Purple Wedge for music. What Men Without Hats hit was a musical response to clubs cracking down on mosh pits?
Of course.
Yes. Dana.
First of all, they only had the one hit.
Oh, yeah. Safety Dance.
Yes.
I didn't know that was a response.
I didn't know that was a response either. It was a response to them cracking down on what?
Mosh pits.
Oh, okay.
That makes me like the song more. Like, I already like the song, but I'm like, oh, it's about going to a mosh pit if
it's
you feel like
something.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
It makes more, honestly,
it makes more sense now.
Like, for the first time in my life, I'm like, oh, safety dance. Okay. That's why it's that.
Wait, is this the video with the maypole and the Renaissance
they're dancing,
thing?
Like in a kind of frolicking.
Like a willow type.
I guess that's the joke. What's the opposite of a mosh pit?
Right.
I understand the song. It makes so much more.
Wow.
This is a great card.
That's a good card.
That was valuable.
All right. Lime Green Wedge, because it's 80s, not green. Lime Green for movies. What film stars Woody Allen as a talent agent who represents dead-end acts like piano plinking birds and balloon folders? Colin.
Is that Broadway Danny Rose?
Correct!
Yeah.
Never heard of him.
He's made a lot of movies.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. Sports and Leisure. Orange Wedge, who was the first runner to hold simultaneous U.S. records for all distances from 800 to 10,000 meters?
Oh, 800 to 10,000. Oh, okay. Well.
I'm guessing FloJo?
Incorrect.
Oh. I mean, it's 80s, but I mean, Carl Lewis?
Incorrect.
I don't think he ran the long distances.
It is a woman.
Okay, all right.
Can we narrow it down? I don't know.
So it's not
And it was too early for Jackie Joyner Kersee, right?
Well, you might as well just say it.
Jackie Joyner Kersee?
No.
Okay.
Oh, who is it? Who is
Mary Decker Slocum.
Oh, okay. I know the name. I definitely know her name.
Not,
yeah.
In, the
not in the punch bowl.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. I know the name from the 80s, Mary Decker Slaney. Okay. All right.
All right. Good job, Brains. Totally
good job,
80s.
Great job.
Yeah.
Rad job.
That was a good one. That was a good card. Oh. Well, Karen, this week we're going to be talking about testing.
Yeah,
and
you
exams.
Suggested it.
I did. I suggested this one. So, as listeners of at least the last couple episodes know, I have a new baby girl at home.
Yeah.
I had the idea for this one when we were in the hospital, and you know, immediately after babies are born, as I know you guys know, Chris and Dana, having gone through this as well, they administer a series of tests to the baby. You know, just they have the reflexes and just basic, you know, just the Apgar scores and things like that. So
okay.
I was thinking, like, oh, it's interesting. Like, we come into this world being tested. You know, it's like she's not even 10 minutes old yet, and she's already having her first test. And I was just thinking, like, oh man, we haven't talked about testing in general, as a broad category.
That's a very enlightening and depressing way of seeing that we're born into a world of testing.
And then I was thinking back to, on the far other end of the scale, how happy that I was the day I took my final college exam. I was walking around campus. I felt so light that day. You know what I mean?
That is such an important day in memory in my life.
Oh, yeah.
Because
when Colin took his last exam in eighth grade. And
yes, I remember that moment. I was like, I never have to do this ever again in my life.
That's right. And now what do you do? Just pub trivia all the time.
So this week, don't panic. This is only a test.
The test begins. Now, la, 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 la.
Thought I was smart. I thought I was right. I thought it better not to fight. I thought there was a virtue in always being the dude. But then it came.
All right, I'll kick it off. I have a general subject quiz about tests just to warm you up and get you in the mood. All right, this is a buzzing question. Buzzers ready? First question. Which staple of standardized testing takes its color from a famous diamond?
Whoa.
Takes its color?
Yeah.
Takes its color.
Chris.
Is it the pencil?
The pencil.
The pencil.
Oh, okay.
Why are they yellow?
Yeah.
Why are they yellow?
Yeah, I think we talked about this, right? It's like the Kohinoor diamond.
The Kohinoor diamond is a famous yellow diamond. Mm. And before this company, LNC Hardmuth Company, introduced like some really fancy top of the line pencils, and they wanted to signify that they were like the best pencils. So they made them yellow, and they called them the Kohinoor pencil. Mm. And then people were like, oh, these are... That's a good idea to make pencils yellow. Ours are also fancy. And so, like, all pencils became, like, yellow. That's why they're yellow.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's because of a diamond?
Yeah.
Marketing.
Marketing.
Yeah. Actually, can I interrupt with a cool related story?
Yes.
So, yesterday I went to Chris's your old neighborhood, Dynamo Donuts. It's a famous donut shop in San Francisco, and I'm eating donuts. Of course, what am I doing? I'm reading about donuts on Wikipedia.
Sure.
The pastry pink boxes is kind of, everybody uses
them.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So there's a reason why they're pink.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
This is mostly due to Cambodia. Which is very interesting. So refugees of the Cambodian genocide moved to Southern California, and they started bakeries and the donut industry, you know, having like coffee, like very simple diners. They're so good that at one point, like almost all the donut shops are owned by Cambodians.
Nice.
And so what they wanted was they wanted boxes for donuts to be a red color because that's the auspicious good luck color. They realized that the leftover pink stock of cardboard boxes is the cheapest. And so they're like, this will
go. Close enough.
Yeah.
And because they're in LA and it became a thing, it's like in movies and in TV that people adopted the pink boxes. And it's like,
you latch on to the market leader.
And now it's like, now all pencils of that type is yellow.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Next question. Which PBS show is tied with Cook's Illustrated and Cook's Country Magazines?
Which
PBS show is like affiliated with those?
Oh.
Karen.
Is this America's Test Kitchen?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Yep.
I think it's the nerdiest cooking show on TV.
It's super nerdy.
Really? Yeah. So
because
good.
It's everything is, okay, how do you make macaroni and cheese? Yeah. Well, we made 25 different macaroni and cheese recipes, and then this is the best
this
one.
This is the best
found.
One. Yeah.
This is the best one pulled through, you know, from all of the different.
Whoa.
Yeah. You need to heat it at this temperature for this long, and then right. when you put your thermometer, it should be this number, and they pull it out, and it's exactly that number, and then they're like, and then you do this, and you stir it 6 times, and then you're like, and it's like, oh my god, you know the answer
the
to
data.
All the, it's not art, it's a science. It's so good. Okay, next question. Which test was invented in 1921 by a Swiss psychiatrist? Karen.
The Rorschach test.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't know if it was called the ink blot test. Or
that's
Rorschach
the other
test.
Name. For
oh, okay.
It. But it was invented official. By a Swiss
Mr. Rorschach. Doctor.
That's Dr. Rorschach to you.
Ambiguous design tests. And those have been around for a long time. Like Da Vinci and Botticelli did some of those where they're like, what do you think when you see this ambiguous picture? But he used it to get insights into people's psychology. He published a book about it. It came out. He was 36 when he published the book. The next year, when he was 37, he died.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He like made a huge splash, a huge wave, a thing that we still talk about today.
A huge plot.
And then the next year he died.
I didn't know that.
That's sad.
It was sad. Crazy. All right. Which widely recognized personality test was created by a mother-daughter duo? Karen.
That is the Myers-Briggs type indicator.
Yes.
Yeah. I was really into that for a while.
Yeah.
It's like the one where you can be separated into like 16 personality types.
Your four letters. Right. Yeah.
That was another one of the tests we took in the testing metrics.
Do you guys know your own?
Oh, I don't remember.
Yeah.
No,
I had it. I did it once in college, but I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's yours, Steve?
I am INTP. Introversion, intuition, thinking, and perception.
Yeah.
I believe it's called the logician.
I might be that sounds that's, very similar.
That might be all of us.
Yeah.
Whatever the best one is, I was the best one.
Instead of P, I'm a J.
Judging?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like I make a decision based on the information.
Chris would be extrovert.
Mm. He's like, no.
Although you know what they say that they say a lot about a lot of introverts.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
It's true.
So this was really interesting. It was created by Catherine Cook Briggs and Isabel Briggs Myers. That was her daughter. Neither of them were formally educated in psychology. They just got really into judging people by their personalities. Like they were. Catherine Cook Briggs was like, my son-in-law has a real interesting personality. And she's like, oh, I guess people have different kind of ways of being. And then she got into typography and she did all this apprenticeship. She did a lot of like her own research. And especially when Jung came out, she was really into it and like read and came up with this typography and her daughter was into it. Her daughter wrote a mystery novel based on the typography and it won Best Mystery Novel of the Year that year. I thought that was cool. And then they thought the personality tests could be used to help women entering the workforce during World War II figure out like who they are as people and what kind of job they should see.
Nice.
Yeah. But I had no idea it was a mother-daughter team.
I did not know that.
I personally like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle personality type.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's how I
just
mean,
the four.
No, I'm actually a big proponent. I think, like, a good team would have each of their personality.
Oh, which one are you?
Oh, I'm Mikey.
Yeah, that's
funny. I'm Michelangelo. I've thought about us.
Oh, okay.
She's like, I'm not joking, Tanner.
Oh, yeah. Right.
All right, so who are we?
I have a guess of who I am.
Chris is Raphael.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I feel like you're Donatello, Dana.
That was my guess, yeah.
And then Colin is Leonardo.
Okay.
Nice.
All right.
Or, I mean, maybe me and Chris can swap, too, and he's Michelangelo. I'm Raphael.
I can see that.
But I like
am
pizza.
Am I cool but rude, or am I a party dude?
Party dude.
Not sure. But importantly, you would not assemble a team of people who did not all like pizza.
That's true.
Ninja skills.
Use deadly weaponry.
Yep.
And did not have genetic mutations.
Pizza, slang, and disrespect for authority.
Yeah.
I think we could apply the Sex and the City character lens.
Oh, true.
Yeah.
Except Hogwarts. We're all like Charlotte's and Miranda's.
All Miranda's.
We need a combined personality score that combines your Sex in the City with your Teenage Mutant Ninja
Turtles.
With your Hogwarts house.
Jedi or Sith.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What does the President's Challenge test?
Colin. I did this.
That is physical fitness, yes?
Physical fitness. It's for kids.
I don't fondly remember, but I remember the flexed arm hang. That was my least favorite part of presidential fit. When in my life, am I going to need to flexed arm hang? But I remember
I would actually like to take this time to, quite frankly, just apologize to President Clinton for failing this challenge.
Oh, I have a follow-up question on this. Which U.S. president renamed the President's Council on Physical Fitness, the people who administer the President's Challenge? They renamed it from the Council on Physical Fitness and Sports to the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition. Colin.
Barack Obama.
Yeah,
the nutrition part, yeah.
Michelle Obama's cause was nutrition and trying to eliminate childhood obesity. So. Mm-hmm. And then the last question, which I feel like is such a pub quiz question, and I wanted to make sure we all agree and know the answer to this one. It is, where was the first atomic bomb tested? Doesn't it feel like a thing? Oh, you should just
first
know this.
Tested.
But first one.
Yeah. Colin. What state?
New Mexico.
New Mexico. Alamogordo.
I was going to say Alamogordo.
What was the obvious answer?
I mean, it could have been Bikini Atoll because SpongeBob.
Because of SpongeBob.
They did, and also Nevada. They did it in Nevada.
Yeah, I was going to guess Nevada.
Part of the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. It was called, the code name for it was Trinity.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were the three things?
There were no three things.
It was just into it.
Yeah, Oppenheimer was like, it's Project Trinity.
That sounds pretty badass. You have to admit.
I think it was Gizmo was the original or something like that. It was like a cute name. And I was like, oh, what a cute name. And then he's like, it's Trinity.
Yeah.
Anyway, good job, you guys. You passed the test.
Wow.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So, Dana, you mentioned, you know, using pencils on standardized tests. But of course, you understand that you cannot simply use any pencil on a standardized test. Oh, no. You have to use a number 2 pencil on that standardized test at severe penalty.
Oh, yeah.
So you're going to fail.
Who knows? You're going to fail. You're going to get scored a 0. You use a number 1 pencil or a number 3 pencil, you're
not getting into college.
Your hand is falling off.
This was always a question. In fact, I mean, we had acquired some pencils at a garage sale or something like this. We had this big box of pencils when I was a kid, and they were 2.5 Ticonderoga pencils.
Yeah, I've seen those.
And I really
they were garbage.
Wondered. Yeah, useless. And I wondered what the difference was. Now I'm doing so. I think that probably at least Karen and Colin are going to do a really good job of pretending to not know about the pencil grading system here because, I mean, they're literally both graphic designers. They've got architecture background. Just pretend you guys don't.
Okay.
Know. What is a number 2 pencil? What makes a number 2 pencil so special? What happens if you use a number 3 pencil?
How many numbers are there?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Where are all the numbers? What is a number 2 pencil? First of all, we call it the inside of the pencil, a thing you actually write with. We call it lead. Mm-hmm. It's not really lead.
Right.
What is it? Graphite, which is a type of coal, basically. The lead in the pencil is generally a mix of graphite and clay.
Mm.
So they powder the graphite and then they put it with clay. Now, it used to just be just like straight up just graphite. Depending on how much clay you put in there, a couple of things will happen. More graphite, less clay. The lead's going to be softer, which means that you're going to be able to get more graphite down onto the page more easily, and you're going to be able to put a lot more blackness on the page. As the lead gets harder, more clay in there and less graphite, it doesn't go onto the page as easily, which means that you're going to be able to use that to do things that are less black, more gray. So, none of this answers the question. Well, we're sort of getting towards the answer. Number two is a nice middle ground, basically. It's not super soft, and because it might be nice to use a soft pencil, because then, you know, you don't really have to write as much to get a nice black line on the on the page, right? But when the lead is really soft, it's going to break a lot, and it's going to smudge a lot.
Yeah.
Like, if you get your hand in there, you're going to just smudge it everywhere. Whereas number three pencil, harder lead, great, but it's a lot harder to make a black mark on the paper. Now, there is no, like, industry-wide standard for what a number two is. In other countries, they rate it on a scale of B's and H's and things like that, like hardness or blackness.
Right,
And sometimes you have, you know, a 2B or a 2H. You know, I mean, it's but a number two pencil is, it's not super soft. It will smudge, but it won't smudge that much.
And the one, it's also, one is softer.
Yes,
right?
The one is softer and the three is harder.
I have so many burning questions.
I may have answers.
Okay, so first of all, is the Scantron scanning all these pencil marks in the test, would it pick up anything but number two?
So we have to go back to the earliest Scantron machines.
Okay, yeah.
So the earliest Scantron machines, and that's the machine that once you fill in all the little bubbles on the test, it reads the little bubbles. Yeah. The way that they worked was like this. They would shine a bright light against the back of the paper, and then the optical device could see where, basically it was seeing where light wasn't getting shown into it. The number one pencil would have filled it in.
Right, that would have worked.
Smudging would have been bad.
Yeah.
The number three pencil, on the other hand, with the earliest Scantron machines, the mark that it would make when you're filling it in would be too light, and the light would shine through it. A black pen, the light would shine through it. The black pen was not opaque enough when you put down the ink on the page. That's why you can't use a pen.
Because ink is translucent.
Right.
Got it.
But the number two pencil, by depositing, I mean, because it's depositing little bits of graphite, that refracts the light.
It's a physical process.
It physically blocks the light. Exactly. So it's not shining through the ink. It there's so many little bits that it just scatters all the light and it doesn't let it through. That's why the number two pencil.
I knew that like a one would work.
Yes.
Like, and technically.
Then you smudge it across.
The three, if
but I didn't there, quite know why.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd really have to sit there coloring really hard with three to get it down.
Well, now the pen thing makes so much sense.
Yeah. I never thought about the pen.
Ink is clear.
Yeah.
Yep.
And if you have the number three, you fill it in. It's like it creates like a little bowl. You know what I mean? It's like it doesn't. Yeah.
Today's machines, by the way, are much higher tech.
Yeah.
They do not shine light through the thing anymore. In fact, if you're using a double-sided sheet, you know what I mean, that where you're filling in bubbles on both sides.
Oh, right.
You're no longer using that technology.
True. That's true.
So I mean, we're all done with tests, but you know, except for these self-imposed ones that we do on the show. I know a lot of our listeners, you know, probably have a lot of tests ahead of them. You know, when the SAT comes around or a standardized test like that, especially if it's your first time ever in that environment of like, you know, taking the SAT, do a practice test. And do that practice test filling in the little bubbles with a wooden number two pencil, because that's what you're going to be doing in the real test.
Mm.
You're going to freak out a little bit more if you've never practiced it before. So don't just take a practice test and like do some questions and look at it. Like literally, like, you know, sit in a quiet room, have somebody time you, have the same kind of pencil, and practice it as close to a real test as you can, so that you learn a little bit more about how the test works. And then also you're just a lot less freaked out.
I have a piece of trivia about the SAT. It is no longer the number one college entrance exam.
Really?
Oh, really?
The ACT is more.
Has finally passed it?
Yeah.
Is what, people take it more?
Yeah, a lot more. Hmm. Yeah, on the incline since 2012, something like that.
Interesting. Yeah.
I'm gonna look at a verbal SAT and I'll pull out some of the questions. But I looked at a sample verbal SAT, and now there are no free floating questions anymore. It is everything in the verbal SAT. Well, there's the essay section, obviously, but then also there is literally, they give you a passage. It's like an edit test. It's literally what my job is, because they give you a passage and then they underline certain sections of that passage. Mm-hmm. And like, it'll say, this sentence should A, stay where it is, B, whoa, be moved up into paragraph one.
Huh.
C, should be moved into paragraph two. And then it's also like, this sentence should be deleted or not deleted. Yes, because it doesn't explain the rest of the, it doesn't fit with the rest of the paragraph. No, because it's an important transition between this idea and that idea.
That's really
and then other things are like, it just underlines like a phrase, and it's like, maybe it'll be a possessive or a plural, and it'll say, oh, this should have an apostrophe or not have an apostrophe. Okay. And then one of them is, don't change it. It is all applied work.
That's actually helpful.
I got so into it. I was like, SAT is cool. SAT, man.
Piggybacking on your pencil segment, you guys know and listeners know that I attended the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament.
Yes.
The New York Times Crossword Puzzle Tournament held in Connecticut. It is super hardcore and intense. We went with our friend Tyler Hinman, who's the past champion of 5-time champion before, and people were so nice. People are so jazzed just to meet and to talk to, you know, they're just so nice. I met Will Shorts, you know, the puzzle master, and I just, everybody is super warm.
I feel like you're leaving out a real important piece of your story.
Before the tournament, I had to practice because I do the New York Times crossword on the app on my phone.
Okay.
So I'm, I am by speed faster than someone who would write it or play fill it in the newspaper, because I'm using my thumbs. Yeah. Everything's kind of automated. I can go to the next clue and I can see the clue right below the puzzle. And it is so different to do it the original paper manual way because you have all your clues on one side and you have to like keep track where you're looking and then you have to write. And I completely forgot how long it takes to write, because I don't really write that much. You know, I don't, you know, everything's typed. And so I was just like, my handwriting is bad, and I have to think about, then I have to get, I get strategic.
I forgot how to make an L.
It looks like a C. And I had to, not me, but like the group suggested that you better practice and find out what pencil you like.
That's
and
a good
I was
idea.
Like, I didn't even think about that.
Wow. Right. Even just things like your hand cramping or, you know, a comfortable grip.
I'm like, oh, I'm going to go for, you know, hardcore, intense, like high-tech mechanical pencil. Oh, but what lead is 0.5 or 0.7? And you know, I'm trying it out. And then you know what? At the end of the day, number two,
classic.
We're just used to it. It felt good in my hand. It was weighty.
It's a reason it's a classic. But no, you're still living out there. One of the most important parts of the story.
One most important thing is I came in almost last place out of everybody.
That is not what I mean.
But though I didn't do, I'm pretty good at crosswords. These people are geniuses, right? And I'm at the bottom like 50 of the people. But I did win on style because I showed up dressed as a big number two pencil, with the yellow and then the pink eraser on top. Yeah. A lot of people wore like crazy crossword dresses and suits and stuff, and I was like, oh, maybe more people will like dress up. Nope, just me. Just showed up, and then I got onto the New York Times. There's a picture of like
the
silent room of just all these competitors in a row with their little paper gates, and you just see my big eraser head like pop up.
There's Karen.
Good old standard number two.
Did you have to take a test to get into it?
No, you don't.
Oh, you just go off.
It's not going
to
be.
Turns out they don't need to have a weed out.
They don't.
Life is its own weed out. They for the crossword puzzle tournament.
They really don't.
I really want to go.
And it is difficult. I described it as, I'm on the JV high school swimming team and I'm competing at the Olympics.
Like against Michael Phelps?
Yeah. That's what it, feels.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm good.
And you're better than the general population.
Yeah, but I'm not at
Sometimes
Olympic
the underdog pops out though.
Sometimes they do.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, speaking of tests, I have a quick quiz. We talked about the SATs. We talked about Myers-Briggs, which were in my quiz, and so I don't have to ask those questions anymore. But, you know, we're born, as you said, Colin, being tested. And so here I have tests that are commonly known by their abbreviations or acronyms, shorthands, and I'm going to ask you what the full name stands for.
Okay.
For example,
these have come up for sure.
This has come up in trivia. Yeah. And I remember once at Soma Street Food when we had trivia, we met two Canadian doctors.
Yes.
Who are listeners and they're in town and then they're on our team. And then there was the question of, what does the MCAT stand
and
for?
And I think ironically, we got it wrong.
No, I think we got it right.
Okay, all right. It's a better story. Sure. Yeah.
And for this quiz, buzz in with your answer. Maybe you want to test how healthy your heart is and you might get an EKG. What is an EKG? What does it stand for? Chris.
Electrocardiogram.
Electrocardiogram or graphy.
Yeah. Okay.
EKG or ECG.
But so, the K is intentional. It's not like they forgot how to spell electrocardiogram. They're just too embarrassed to say anything.
So no one tell them. It's actually a C. If you are a lady, this is very important, and you might have to get a pap smear or a pap test. What is pap short for? Dana.
No.
This is a kind of a tricky question.
You said short for. Yeah, I thought you meant like it was abbreviated. I mean, I thought it was going to be an acronym, but.
Papilloma?
That's what a lot of people think.
Because of
it is pelvic. Named after the Greek doctor Georgios Papanikolaou. So the official name of the pap smear test is Papanikolaou test, abbreviated as a pap test.
I did not know that.
Because people might think, like, oh, human papillomavirus, something. Yeah. It's nothing to do with that.
I thought it was maybe pelvic.
Oh, sure.
Ambulatory. I don't know. Yeah. Assessment.
Procedure.
Yeah.
Papanikolaou.
Why do you think they abbreviated it?
Papanikolaou. All right. And so maybe you're going to get some x-rays taken to see, to test how healthy your body is. You might get a CT scan. What does CT stand for?
A CT, not a CAT.
It's the same.
I think it might be the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, I know a CT, it's a CAT is computerized axial tomography, yes?
Tomography is the...
So maybe this is the same C and T?
Yes, you're correct.
Oh, okay. All right.
It is a computed tomography.
Yes, not topography.
Not topography, as a lot of people mistaken. Tomography is a cross-section, and topography is, kind of elevation.
Yeah.
So that is the difference, and it's x-ray. Okay. Not to be confused with another test called the MRI.
Yes.
Also to image parts of your body. What does MRI stand for? Dana.
Magnetic resonance imaging.
Correct. Yeah. You are correct. What does the IQ test stand for? What does IQ stand for? Colin.
That is intelligence quotient.
Correct.
Yeah.
It is developed by a German psychologist. And at first, it's actually one word. Intelligence quotient.
Oh, in German.
They love smash words.
Yeah, they're very efficient.
Just call it the eye test there.
That's confusing.
Let's talk about some academic tests. What does GRE test stand for? This is the test that you take for your high school diploma.
That is the graduate record exam.
Correct. Graduate record exam.
That was readiness exam. That would have been my guess. Yeah.
Graduate ready if you're ready for it. If you are a foreigner, you might have to take the TOEFL I did. What does TOEFL stand for? Chris.
Test of English as a Foreign Language.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. What does the GMAT stand for? So we got to take the GMAT.
Now, this is for medical school, right? I guess you're not going to tell. No. GMAT is... No, that's the MCAT.
Yeah, what school?
Oh, the GMAT is for business school, right? Is it... Man, it's general something aptitude test.
Well, sure.
General managerial aptitude test.
So almost close for a lot of those words.
Yeah?
It is for the MBA, of course. Graduate management admission test.
So, makes sense. I got one out of four.
You got the test. Vibrate, the feeling.
So relatedly, you have the LSAT, which is the law school admission test, MCAT, medical college admission test, PCAT, pharmacy college, VCAT, veterinary college.
Okay.
So all of them is blank, blank. Admission test.
Okay. All right.
And lastly, we talked about before the SATs. What does SAT stand for now?
Oh.
Now.
Chris.
Well, it used to be Scholastic Aptitude Test. Did they change it?
Oh. Well, what are you guys, what are you guys guessing?
I would have guessed Scholastic Aptitude Test. But yeah, when you said now, I could see that maybe rebranding.
Standardized Admissions Test.
Currently, the SATs are called the SATs.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't stand for anything.
Really?
They just call it the SAT test.
It's like KFC now.
Yeah, it's like KFC. It's like, you know, it's not Kentucky Fried, it's just called KFC. So.
That is still called Kentucky Fried.
Originally, it was Scholastic Aptitude Test.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And then, you know, they're kind of like, this doesn't really determine every aptitude of everything. So then they changed it to Scholastic Assessment Test. Then they called it SAT Reasoning Test. Then they kind of got rid of the actual what SAT stand for. Now it is the SATs stands for nothing. And we got one last test segment. Colin.
So we've a
home stretch.
Yeah, I'll take us home here. With one of our old favorites here that we've talked about on the show, Thomas Edison.
Good old Thomas Edison.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about him a lot, and I think the most charitable thing, I mean, aside from legitimately, you know, inventing a lot of stuff,
we can debate
what he may have copied or been inspired by other people. We can all agree one thing is that he was a prickly man, and just by all accounts, kind of hard to work with. So we're talking about testing. This is something that I came across a couple years ago, just in my travels on the internet, and I was like, oh man, I love this story. It just seemed really appropriate, so I went and kind of dug it up again. So back in the early 1900s, you know, Edison, I mean, he was huge. I mean, he was like a national figure, like an Elon Musk or somebody like that, where it's just, you know, synonymous with just high-flying business and, you know, maybe a little crazy at the time. His company, he got to a point where he was really dissatisfied with the caliber of people he was hiring. Okay. And so, you know, the same way, I know it's not as much now as it was maybe 10 years ago, but like, remember how it was like, oh, I heard, you know, the Google interview questions or, the Facebook interview questions.
And
I
think logic puzzles.
Yeah.
We've talked about these on the show before as they become almost legendary in terms of like how, not tricky maybe, but how sharp and pointed they can be in terms of getting into how job applicants think. So Edison had kind of a similar program that he came up with. In the early 1900s, in the teens, he decided he was going to put together, all right, this is my hiring exam.
Whoa.
And it was insane. Absolutely insane. I mean, he's just such a control freak.
He just wants a tribute.
And just such a, you know, for a man who himself had limited formal education, I mean, obviously a smart guy, this was, the test he put together is bananas. he put together a quiz of 146 questions.
Wow.
That he was to administer to himself, himself.
I mean, I feel like that's the key piece of information about this. It's like a micromanagement demonstration or what. Yeah.
He does not sound like the kind of guy who would delegate this out and trust other people's. Yeah.
To just give somebody a piece of paper to take a test.
Right. To come into Edison factories and start contributing. What's hilarious to me about this is that even contemporaneously, when word got out that Mr. Edison has put together this insane list of interview questions, it became a story unto itself. Yeah. Okay. And people would start, you know, leaking the questions and talking about it. And he became irate when questions, because he'd have to reformulate.
He's out of control now.
Exactly. It's a control freak issue. So at one point, actually, the New York Times, the gray lady herself, this is an article from 1921. And the New York Times in 1921 published an article about basically the insanity of Thomas Edison's quiz here. So the headline is, Edison questions stir up a storm. And the subhead is victims, in quotes, victims of tests say only a walking encyclopedia could answer the questionnaire.
Oh, well.
Official list a secret. But man, who, this is back in the days when the New York Times would have six headlines before you get to the actual story, of course. But man who remembers 141 questions tells what they were and calls them silly.
Well, and I guess if he can remember 141, I mean, he probably
could get hired.
Yeah. I think that's a really fair point, Dana. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Anybody who can take this test realizes that they would never want to work there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that's true.
Smart enough to not work there.
Yeah. The New York Times reproduced.
They published
good.
All of these questions.
This guy's recollections.
Yes. Them. Yeah. This, that one Mr. Hansen, that he said anyway, that he could recall. And it is something to behold. It's such a weird mix of geography and science and history.
This sounds fun.
Math. Oh, it is really fun. You know, we can post a link to it maybe on our Facebook group or something if people want to actually take all these questions. I mean, even putting myself in the mindset of a 1921 college graduate, they seem just insanely random and hard. Yeah. And yet at the same time, some of them from today's standard, like, you know, a grade school kid would know them. So there's some things that have become
common knowledge, that have
become just in the time since then common knowledge. Yeah. I thought it would be fun.
Oh, yeah,
to maybe pull out some of these questions for you guys and just give a sample of sort of the easy extremes and the crazy hard extremes here. I'll give you an example of what I mean of some of the easy ones. What is the highest mountain? What is the highest mountain?
Everest.
It's Mount Everest. Yeah.
Okay.
What country are earthquakes most frequent? And it's maybe not surprisingly, it's Japan. Oh, yeah, okay. I'm not trying to trick you here.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm putting myself in a 1920s mindset. Okay.
Which U.S. president started a speech with the words 47 years ago?
Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, Abraham. Exactly. Okay. Where is Copenhagen?
Denmark.
You know, yeah, exactly. So some of these are like, okay, you know, average high school student, we would hope, would maybe know some of these.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some of these, like, I don't know why Rhode Island is the smallest state. What is the next smallest?
Delaware.
It is, in fact, Delaware. Very good. I cannot for the life of me imagine why Thomas Edison thought this was important, that all of his incoming hires know this information. It's just crazy.
They know about the world.
I'm sure you guys all know, you know, just as easily, you know what state has the largest amethyst mines, right? I mean, you have that information. Just
I mean, he's a industrialist. Readily he's a business guy. He's going to tell you about amethyst mines at some point over breakfast.
Arizona.
You
hang out
with. It is actually Virginia. At least of in 1921.
Sure.
Yeah, in 1921, Virginia had the largest amethyst mine. You know, some of the questions actually we've talked about at Good Job Brain. He asked,
really?
What is shellac?
Oh, it's bug.
The resin from the lac beetle, right. But then some of these, I mean, come on. Name three powerful poisons.
Okay, that one was on the test.
I do like Harry Potter.
It is.
If you were going to murder someone, what did you learn in college, Fringe?
I bet, honestly, you guys might even be able to name three of the
powerful poisons.
Yeah, so again, arsenic is one.
Like death?
Yes. Like,
cyanide.
Cyanide is one. Specifically cyanide of potassium. I think he would have accepted cyanide. So we got arsenic, cyanide. Yeah. The third one is a very kind of old-timey poison.
The one he likes to use. Most preferred.
Hemlock.
I'm going too old. He was looking for strychnine.
Okay.
Sure.
This definitely is. Exactly.
Is a biography.
140 things that I know.
I know.
Yeah.
Who discovered how to vulcanize rubber? I bet we know this one. We've talked about this.
Michelin?
Firestone? You're thinking the right. It's Charles Goodyear. Yeah.
Almost close.
Yeah, you were close. Yep. You were close.
You were in the right ballpark.
What are axe handles made of?
Wood.
What? Oh no, that's not good enough for Thomas Edison, my friend. If you were smart ass enough to say wood, you would get yourself booted out of town.
Really.
He is looking for
oak.
Well, ash is generally used in the East. and hickory in the West.
This was somebody's grandpa telling you a real cool story on a long train ride.
Like, my collection of
what happened? Oh my god! On the East Coast.
Well, actually. He has some trick questions in here, too, which, I mean, I guess I can't be surprised, you know, that he would throw, you know, so, what cereal is used in all parts of the world?
Lucky Charms.
Rice.
You're like, I would have guessed rice. That would be my answer, too, for sure. No cereal is used in all parts of the world.
Wheat is used extensively
with rice and corn next.
Holy.
They don't use any cereal in the North Pole, for example.
I'm like, how old is he? Oh, this is like a 9-year-old.
Oh my god, that is so good.
Yeah.
Wrong. No cereal. Not, cereal.
It was a trick question. Yeah. What do you think of that?
It's all damn you, Edison.
Well, it's like you can't tell what level of detail he wants. Like, axe handles, you could argue almost any wood could be an axe handle.
No, you hit it on the, it's like it's from super precise to kind of just vague. Yeah. Who invented printing?
Gutenberg. Oh, Gutenberg?
Nobody knows. Somebody in China, Japan, or Korea probably first invented in Europe by Coster, you know?
Wait a minute. So the guy who recalled the 140, he also got the answer key?
This is a combination of the New York Times' answers. Yeah, good question. I'm glad you asked that. Okay. Of what the guy recalled and the New York Times basically assembling their crack team of answers
I mean, if Edison is administering this test in person, he might get the answer.
Exactly.
Like,
yes.
Actually, no cereal.
I see you wrote here.
Yeah, well, that's the second part of it. For Edison to tell you how wrong you are.
Yes, that's
right. He just wanted to slap some college kids. He's like, I didn't go to college. Who's smarter?
Oh, my God.
So the New York Times, they contacted him. You know, they said an effort was made to get from Mr. Edison or his representatives both a reply to the critics and an authentic list of the questions. And he basically blew them off. And his assistant said that, you know, we don't want to make these public because then people can cram, you know, for my application exam. I mean, which I suppose is true. So the Times and other papers, they would make a big show of administering the test to just, you know, they took it to college campuses and see how many people – they gave the test to Einstein. Oh. And I guess, you know, Einstein would have failed as well.
He's like a physicist.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, he doesn't need to know amethyst mines.
Oh, my God. I feel like, you know, at some point you're halfway through the quiz. You're like, wait, tell me again the benefits of this job, Mr. Edison. It is basically just an ego-stroking trivia test.
It's not a synthesis of knowledge or like a demonstration of expertise. It's just, do you know?
He would be that type, and we know that type of pub trivia goers who like has a team of other people like them, but they're not really friends. They just show up to try to win.
It's like
trivia.
A business,
and very mercenary.
And if it shows that they're not going to win,
they leave.
Yeah,
they don't eat any of the food, or they don't drink. Yeah. You know, they're very huffy puffy. That's the type. All right, woo. That was our test episode. Thank you guys for being here. Thank you guys, listeners, for listening. Hope you learned a lot of stuff about Edison being a pill, about the pencil, about standardized tests, and more. And you can find our show on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, and on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Calling all trivia nerds, Brittany here, and I host the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast with my best friend, Meredith. Is your next car ride looking like a snooze fest? We've got the cure. 3 rounds of awesome trivia every week. Harry Potter, Disney, science, sports, you name it. No more silent car troubles. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Connect, laugh, and learn with your kids, big and small. New episodes every week wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast.